Welcome on to a very special edition of the Dunked On Basketball Podcast. That Spurs Clippers game deserves its own separate podcast recorded for posterity, potentially the best postseason first round series ever.
I'd say so.
Yeah. Oh, hi, Danny. So excited about the series, you couldn't even wait for me to introduce you.
I'm at this point, I'm just ready to get some words in, but yeah. Do you want to
start? All right, well, yeah, so, I mean, since you're so eager to discuss, apparently, what are your, 10,000-foot thoughts on the game, the series, whatever?
I mean, I think that if you're talking Game 7, as crazy as it is to go into the narrative, it really does start and finish with Chris Paul, because while you could talk about the emotional component of it, and I'm sure people will, he played incredibly well in this game.
Yeah, he was unbelievable, and I mean, for those who have never injured a hamstring before, and it's basically like you feel like something ripped in the back of your leg, and your hamstrings are essential for basically anything you want to do, whether it's jumping and exploding, whether it's changing direction, you know, really anything that you're going to try and do, running in a straight line, your hamstring is a part of that. And what happens when you initially will hurt your hamstring is, you know, sometimes it won't hurt that badly unless you're trying to do something, but you always have in the back of your mind that if you go hard, it's just going to hurt it worse. And so that was sort of the progression that was happening with Chris Paul throughout the game, is where he would start to feel a little bit better. It'd sort of like pop out of his mind for a little bit, and he'd go a little harder, or, you know, just if there was like some exigency where there was a loose ball or something and he had to just go after it, like your instinct as a player tells you to, and all of a sudden then you hurt it more, and you hurt it more, and that's what keeps happening throughout the game, if you keep playing on a hamstring like that. And just what he was able to do in that game, and especially at the end, off that bad leg, you know, he said in the post-game interview, he felt it really good as he took that shot. I mean, imagine how hard a shot that is, and then to feel like the back of your leg basically ripping as you're trying to make that shot, and he still hit the game winner. One of the greatest performances I think I've ever seen by anyone.
Absolutely. And after the game, you know, as you're kind of sifting through everything, and I also liked basically Chris Paul when he got on the floor, Blake Griffin said he asked him how, you know, what he could do, and Chris Paul said, we'll see, is that he ended up playing 37 minutes in this game. I mean, I honestly, it felt to me like it was an hour that he was out, just because of the feeling of the game and everything else, and you kind of get wrapped up in yourself. But despite everything, he was on the floor more than all but two Clippers.
Yeah, I mean, so a few statistics here for Paul. Just an unbelievable game by anyone in any situation. He was 9 out of 13 from the field, 5 of 6 on threes, 4 of 4 from the line, 27 points on 15 shooting possessions. That's about as good as it gets. Also had 6 assists and 2 steals, and of course, unbelievable clutch play going down the stretch.
And only one turnover.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think he had like 28 assists and one turnover over, you know, the last two games of the series or something like that. Like just, or whatever the time period was, it's still a very impressive accomplishment.
Yeah. I just looked at it because I have the final box in front of me. And it's also amazing that, and I'm sure we'll get into this with another player, this might actually be a lead-in, is that Chris Paul played more minutes than every Spur but one, and that's Tim Duncan, who played 16 more seconds.
Yeah, really, really fantastic. Let's see, so a couple other big takeaways here, just in a more macro sense. Blake Griffin, this game, in many respects for him, was a culmination of many things for him. You'll recall he used to have horrible issues from the free throw line, 10 of 11 from the line last night. You'll recall that he couldn't hit a jump shot. Well, he was making his jumper. You recall that he was just a dunker. Well, you know, I still maintain that he wasn't quite right physically. He wasn't, you know, able to post up or have the type of spin moves or aggression or finishing that he had earlier in the series. Didn't matter. Still was able to score extremely well. Made some clutch free throws. He was, considered not that great of a defensive player. Had some really nice verticality plays to force missed layups down the stretch. So, really, for Griffin, a lot of redemption for him as well from some of the kind of tired old criticisms of him. And he was able to do it when he didn't have his explosiveness and his body wasn't quite right. And he still persevered as well, despite playing a ton of minutes.
Two things I'll add with Blake. His passing was extremely important in this game. He's a very good passer, but we saw it a lot. And also, to me, he was the big man anchor for this team because there were some stretches that DeAndre Jordan didn't play. And they needed everything from Blake. They needed offense from him. They needed just kind of that functionality. They needed somebody the defense would focus on. And they needed somebody to do more defensively than he usually does. And he picked up all of the slack that they needed. And as we saw with the Clippers the entire series, they needed people to do that from Chris Paul consistently. And a lot of that, while some of the credit also goes to other guys like Jamal Crawford, Blake deserves a ton of credit for stepping up at exactly when they needed it. And the other guy I'll mention with that is Redick. Redick hit some gigantic shots in this game.
Yeah, 4-7 on threes. Those two threes that he made in the fourth quarter, both extremely tough looks. With great defenders on him, Green, and the first one was on Manu, but the second one was on Green. He another guy who I think probably doesn't quite get his due. And also, everyone really rags on Doc Rivers and, oh, that Bledsoe trade was so terrible, and they got Dudley and Redick and that. J.J. Redick is a wonderful player, and the spacing that he provides to this team added a totally new dimension for them from previous years, and he's been a great pickup. He can play a ton of minutes. He works his butt off and didn't really get taken advantage of too badly defensively in this series. So I agree that Doc has not at all maximized his assets, but I think that trade for Redick, and the contract for him too, I mean, what's he making, like $7 million? What would J.J. Redick get on the open market this soft season? Quite a bit more than that. So let's at least give Doc credit for that. I mean, I'm not saying he's been some unbelievable GM. We all know about his foibles, including the acquisition of his own son, which didn't work out too well even in this game. But he did well in that particular aspect.
Yeah, well, we're going to see how well the acquisition of his son works out in the next series in all likelihood.
With Paul being questionable for Monday, it could get pretty ugly. We'll see.
Since you brought up the Redick trade, it's just this really strange parallel that it's not related to the series, but I think people like us who are CBA nerds will appreciate is that that is the second three-way trade that the Bucks have been involved in the last 2 years, where you could argue they traded away the best player and did not get the best asset in return. Because that's the same thing that happened in the Michael Carter Williams Brandon Knight trade.
Wait, hold on. What do you mean? Who did the Bucks trade away?
They traded away Redick.
You can't hold that against them though, because he was a free agent at the time.
I'm just saying it's kind of
wild to even get.
Yeah.
Yeah. Although I mean that was obviously a terrible trade for them. Getting him from Orlando for 2 months for Tobias Harris, probably not the greatest, but that's neither here nor there for this particular podcast. Last global takeaway before we really get into some of the nitty gritty strategic and other issues. Matt Barnes was unbelievable in this game. His shooting to start off the game, he had to play as a four for a long time. His energy and defense was outstanding. He hit a huge three, probably the biggest shot of the game, I thought, that tied it. At 105 when they were down three with around 2 minutes left. A nice assist by Redick on that play. So Barnes was great. He did very well on Kawhi in the last two games, really held him down about as well as could be expected. So, I mean, and this is a guy who's 34 years old, and he's basically required to provide all of the energy plays for this team and still hit his shots, and he did that extremely well. Another guy who you would say is a bargain that, making around $3 million a year.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think if we want to move into the game itself, what was funny thinking about it, because we're recording this a day after it happened, was remembering that the beginning of the game, the Spurs did such a great job trying to tire out Blake Griffin and Chris Paul.
Yeah, they did. I mean, they were going with splitter either on post-ups or in pick and roll, and Blake was looking a little tired right away. I mean, he's one of those guys who, when he's tired out there, you can tell, and he's not exactly shy about, you know, hiding his exhaustion at times. So, I mean, they were, the Spurs were making some hay with that pick and roll initially. Then the adjustment from the Clippers was to just switch and put Griffin on Parker, which the Spurs weren't able to take advantage of quite as well. Another strategic point in the first quarter was San Antonio was really leaving Barnes open, and he had struggled quite a bit shooting the ball, and he made them pay in that first quarter.
Yeah, he really did. And so it was a completely logical tactical decision by the Spurs at this point to try to make Matt Barnes beat them. But in that first quarter, his points were huge. And, you know, you talk about the importance of the fourth quarter, but if he hadn't made those shots, it would have been a lot harder for the Clippers to stay in it.
Another person who deserves some credit, actually, and someone who's been kind of maligned at times, was Jamal Crawford. Had a wonderful first half in this game. He actually made his presence felt defensively, which is remarkable. He had a number of nice instances where he was able to help and recover, force steals, blow up some actions. He came in with a lot of energy, which is a shock for him. I mean, he's not someone who really expends a ton of energy, but, you know, he had to guard Kawhi Leonard a lot in this series and in this game, and you would have thought that he would just get absolutely killed in that matchup, and he wasn't locking anybody down by any means, but he at least held his own. He wasn't just such a liability that he couldn't be out there, even in what would have seemed like a very tough matchup. So he deserves some credit for that as well, for expanding again, you know, another older guy learning some newer tricks in that.
And he was another guy that the Spurs had to pay attention to, and especially during the time that Chris Paul was out of this game, the Clippers needed as much of that as they could have, because Chris was such an instrumental part of their offense, and also, as you said, Jamal's defense was important in this game as well.
Yeah, so Crawford, when Paul hurt himself with a couple minutes left in the first half or first quarter, Crawford then was basically running the point for them, at least offensively. The Clippers, again, were getting a ton out of that double high pick set. And Crawford, not a guy who's going to operate quite with the advanced level of dribbling and finding people that Chris Paul is. But he was able to get to his spots, hit some shots. He found Big Baby for a jump shot from the top of the key. And that keeping them in it, I mean, whenever Crawford gets hot, you're always waiting for him to cool off and continue shooting. That's ultimately what happened. He had 15 shots in this game, 16 points. So he wasn't incredibly efficient by the time it ended. But for that one period, the Clippers were able to avoid getting killed with Paul out for much longer than he has been out typically in this series, as he was getting that hamstring work done.
Yeah, one other thing that made me chuckle was, I think it was at this point in the game, the Clippers tried the double high with Austin Rivers as the ball handler, and the Spurs yeah. just went, no, this isn't going to work, and it just fell apart a couple times.
Yeah, so getting into the second quarter, Blake Griffin got his third foul and was taken out, of course, you know, with a few minutes left in the second quarter. Finished with four fouls, of course. and granted, it's a little more complex than a lot of us armchair folks would like to make it. Just leave the guy in. He's probably not going to fall out. You know, that's kind of my default in most circumstances. With Blake, at least, and Amari Stoudemire was another guy who used to be like this too in Phoenix, where if he's in foul trouble, he just turns into such a traffic cone defensively. And especially if he was having to go at center during times when DJ was taken out of the game due to Doc not wanting to leave him in during the hack of DJ, that would have made things really difficult for the Clippers. So maybe it worked out that he had less fouls in the second half and was able to defend a little bit better. Because when he was in foul trouble, there were a couple times when Duncan was on him, and Duncan just went right around him, no problem at all.
Yeah, and the point that you brought up in terms of how the player deals with foul trouble is a very astute one that people don't think about as much, and that's, you know, the coach is making a decision, but the player is living with it each time, and there are certain guys that play the same way. There are certain guys that actually are really bad when they're in foul trouble. Like, I think I remember this with Steven Adams, that he just plays the same way, and then he can pick up that fourth really quickly. But with Blake, yeah. he has that in his history that he's very cognizant. And at points, that's a good thing because he's such a valuable player that you want to have him on the floor. But at other times, if the coach is trying to manage it, you can just kind of, you want to tell him, I can do this, you know, I trust you, you can do this. But at a certain point, the players are the ones who have to do it, and a coach at this point in the year should know how his players handle that kind of a situation.
So at this point in the second quarter was when I began calling for Lester Hudson to get more time. Certainly a sentence I never thought I would utter, but, and to be totally honest, I know very little about Hudson's game other than that he was a really old rookie when he came to the league and has pretty good length. But Austin Rivers was just so bad defensively that if there is a downgrade from Rivers to Hudson on offense, which would be somewhat difficult to believe, it's well overshadowed by what Rivers does defensively. I mean, the typical, he just has so many times where he overhelps, loses his man, gets beat on like typical easy plays like elevator doors. But probably the most illustrative example of this was last possession of the half. Pop actually used the hack of DeAndre very well to get another possession, get a 2-for-1 at the end of the half, which is, that's actually a great time to use it. And so then they put Rivers in as a defensive replacement at the very end of the half. And he does the exact same thing he did off of Danny Green, where Green missed a wide open three down the end of game five that could have iced the game for the Spurs at that time. He just, one pass away on the wing, there was penetration. He just loses man, steps in to try and help when that's not what the scheme is. That's someone else's job to help because it's just such an easy pass right to the wing for a wide open three. Rivers did it again. And of course, you know, Green drains the three, puts the Spurs down only three or down only two going into half. I mean, and that's just, you know, that was pointed out to him in the film session that you just don't want to do that. Like, there's no, any competent coaching staff would say, look, this is an example, you can't do this. He does it again. Like, just, it's amazing to me that he is a coach's son when he really struggles so much with the mental aspects of the game and just, you know, overall team play and passing as well.
And what's so shocking to me, not only is it the coach's son component of it, it's that he's still used as a defensive replacement. Dante Jones seems like his entire role is defensive replacement. And especially when you're not asking him to do offensive things, like run the offense, which also Jamal Crawford was better at anyway. So what is the point of having him out there if you don't trust him on defense and you're not using him on offense?
So we'll get into the third quarter now. Paul basically couldn't get over screens when he was guarding Parker, so the Clips stuck with switching a lot, where, you know, Paul would just then be on the big, and the Spurs did not take advantage of that situation nearly as well as they could have when Paul was on the big, either by having the guy roll hard, he would just sort of be standing there, or, you know, going into the post or whatever. I mean, Paul would have had no chance against whoever it was, and he would just kind of deactivate after the switch, but the Spurs couldn't take advantage of that at all.
And also, on the reverse side of the switch, when they were doing it, Blake Griffin had three fouls, and we already saw what Doc did with him in the second quarter, so you could try to push that to get him his fourth, and then you're completely changing the game as well.
So I lamented in a previous podcast, I think after game six, that the Clippers never really get system buckets. It's, you know, back doors, easy baskets at the rim. So they finally get one. Matt Barnes goes back door on Kawhi Leonard, easy layup with maybe about a minute gone in the third quarter. Pop takes Kawhi Leonard out. And I couldn't believe that. I mean, you know, Pop, whatever, he's stern. He sort of has a reputation as a bit of a disciplinarian, whatever. Make that point in December, you know, in January. if you want to prove to everyone, like, this is what happens when you get cut backdoor. Like, the fact that Kawhi Leonard got beat backdoor on that one play, he's a smart player, that almost never happens to him. That doesn't mean that on the next possession, having someone else in there besides Kawhi Leonard is the best way to win the game. And Pop, just because he wanted to prove a point, for whatever reason, took him out. And to just think that there's no way in my mind that you can think to yourself, we're going to be better over these next possessions because Kawhi Leonard is out of the game. And it's just, you know, very disappointing coaching for me, just very old school, needless type of thing, where it really kind of manifested some of the worst qualities of the coaches that really, to be honest, like, everyone hated growing up, where you make one mistake and you're out of there. And, you know, if Kawhi Leonard doesn't have enough equity on defense as the defensive player of the year that he can make one mistake without getting taken out, who does?
And also, who are you trying to instill it in? This is not a young team, particularly on the perimeter. This is a team, you know, Danny Green, Marco Bellinelli. Are you gonna somehow inspire Marco Bellinelli to be better defensively? He is what he is at this point. You know, maybe Corey Joseph could get a little bit of benefit. Corey Joseph, who barely played in this series.
Yeah, you know, it's really it doesn't make much sense. So Paul just continuing his heroics throughout the third quarter. Hitting threes, you know, continuing to aggravate the hamstring. You could see it. He would be clutching at it. Every time he would really try and make an explosive movement, you could tell that it was just getting worse and worse. And that was most typified. Well, actually, we got to get into another awesome Austin Rivers play that since we're recording the day after, I'd forgotten. The shooting foul on Monte Ginobili, 75 feet from the basket. So, did you agree with that call? Should that have been a shooting foul or no? What do you think?
I don't care whether it should be a shooting foul or not. You don't call it that way. I'm sitting here as somebody who covers the NBA as you do, sitting there going, "Oh God, players are going to be doing this for the next 5 years." It's one of those things. It's like if it works once in high school, you're going to do it the rest of your life. It's going to ruin a couple of games next year.
Well, you know, it's funny. I mean, so a lot of players try that already. Most obviously, Paul in that game against the Thunder last year when he tried it and got a turnover as a result when Russell Westbrook stripped him. So the cruel irony that it looked like the Clippers might actually lose a game on the very foul call that Paul was trying to draw last year and always tries to draw, or did at least until maybe he learned his lesson.
It's the Chris Paul tribute play. That's what it is.
But that said, I actually agreed with the call. And
it wasn't a bad call.
And the reason is, usually, guys may have, like, picked up their dribble or something as the foul is coming, but they haven't actually started the shooting motion until the contact takes place. And for me, there was contact after Manu had already started his shooting motion. I mean, he had really gotten the ball above his shoulders, and there was plenty of time for Rivers to just, you know, not foul him and just let him shoot that terrible shot. But instead he did sort of like a weird reach around to the back. And, it was just a horrible play all around. I mean, it was just terrible execution. I mean, cause they had a foul to give. So that's why he was taking it in the backcourt. And it's also really too early to do the foul to give anyway. I mean, like, half a second had elapsed. It wasn't even any point in giving the foul yet.
And also, that led to a ridiculous real final possession because there was so much time left that the Clippers actually got some time left. And
as it turned out, in a crazy way, that play, because Mono only made two out of the three free throws, actually ended up benefiting the Clippers. And this to me was the signature play of this game, perhaps even more than the final shot by Paul, because there was a scrum for the rebound. He actually, and this is actually a big credit to Doc, put Paul back in for Rivers just for that last possession. It was an offensive possession. He'd been sitting for a little bit, but you know, you might as well get Rivers out of there at that point. And Manu missed the last free throw. Paul actually gets the rebound, I think, basically in a scrum. And he'd been sitting for a while, so I think what happens when you've been singing for a while with that injury is you're kind of, you kind of forget how injured you are. So he tried to kind of turbo it back down floor, and about mid-court, you could tell that he was just like, oh yeah, this leg doesn't really work very well. And you almost saw him like snap his head like he was just like stringing expletives at himself. So then he just pulls up from 35 and buries it off the glass anyway. I mean, it was such just a quintessential example of everything that he went through in that game.
Yeah, it was a really remarkable play. And you can think about the dynamic just on a personal level with the team of Austin Rivers just committed a whether you want to call it a stupid foul or whatever, it was frustrating no matter what. Like, you're a coach, and then that's immediately gone. It's washed away. Chris Paul makes a great play, completely shifts the crowd, and gets you in a different place going into the biggest fourth quarter. I would say the biggest fourth quarter for a lot of these guys of their whole career.
Yeah, and at this point, it was 79-78. All I do the advanced stats on Twitter every game. They were all just incredibly close. It was really, I think, total there were 31 lead changes in this game, and every stat was close. It was really one of the more back and forth games that you'll ever see. And one thing that was an interesting strategic wrinkle here was that Pop finally, when he put Kawhi back in, I think, after sitting him for like 6 minutes. And yeah, you know, they didn't get killed during that time period, but, you know, that's sort of the fallacy is, oh yeah, well, you know, we actually did okay in these minutes when this guy was in. Well, okay, if you had a better player in, maybe you would have blown them out in those minutes, or, you know, been up by five or whatever. So, you know, just the idea, and I'm sure when we talk about Atlanta and Washington, we'll get to this a little bit more, but like the idea that, okay, we're treading water here, I don't need to put a guy back in, not really a good way to look at things, in my view.
Especially when you have such a small margin for error.
Yeah, but so Pop actually then finally went with the lineup with Kawhi at the four, and that was pretty effective, especially when Blake Griffin then was forced to play at the five, and this continued then into the fourth quarter, where for the Clippers ended up countering finally with Paul, who was basically on one leg. Redick, never the greatest rebounder, the most athletic. Jamal Crawford, one of the worst rebounders in the history of basketball, playing the three. Barnes, who's a good rebounder for a small forward, but still a small forward at four. And then Blake Griffin, who also wasn't really particularly energetic by that point in the game and not jumping that well either at the five. A terrible, terrible defensive rebounding unit. And that led to 9 offensive rebounds and 12 second chance points for the Spurs in the fourth quarter.
And that was juxtaposed with the Spurs only having 2 total second chance points in the first 3 quarters combined. So they go from 2 in the first 3 quarters to 12 in just the fourth quarter.
Yeah, I mean, and there are some plays, too, where guys didn't really jump at all for the Clippers. You know, early on in the quarter, Kawhi missed an open 3. Dia got the offensive rebound. Neither of those guys jumped. Yeah, that was pretty rough. And then after that play, a really nice example where of how you can deal with a switch. This is something that Steve Kerr actually talked about when Anthony Davis would get switched onto Curry in the New Orleans series, was we don't want you to isolate. We want you to actually work off the ball and put the defensive player, the big, in a position that he's not used to guarding. And that's what the Spurs did. They got a switch of Manu guarded by Blake Griffin. And instead of trying to go one-on-one, Manu gave up the ball, cut down the lane, and then received a down screen to pop out to the wing for a wide-open three. Griffin, not at all used to defending that, couldn't get through the screen. Nobody switched, and Manu buried a three. That was a key shot.
Yeah, it was huge early, and I think that's when I kind of started to think, oh, the Spurs are the Spurs, and then they didn't end up, you know, really closing it in any way there.
So one really unfortunate thing for the Spurs is I actually, if you, throughout most of this series, if you just said which team is playing better overall as a unit more cohesively, I think you would have gone with the Spurs in almost all of the games, maybe other than game one. And the Spurs, I think you could even argue, outplayed the Clippers in this last quarter. But they had so many opportunities, and they just simply could not take advantage. They didn't make up a ton of ground when Paul was out in the first quarter, and the second quarter with his injury. They weren't really able to take advantage of Paul on defense. They weren't really able to, they got a ton of layups in the fourth quarter, and they just couldn't make them. Kawhi missed a couple layups. There was a play where Blake had great verticality after he raced back on his own turnover and forced a Kawhi miss. There was another drive from the right wing where Kawhi kind of slipped as he was going right in. It looked like he had an easy layup. It was really remarkable how many shots at the basket in the fourth quarter the Spurs missed.
Well, yeah, and some of that was also, we talked about the ridiculous amount of offensive rebounds the Spurs got. Some of those were offensive rebounds off their misses off of that should have been made in the first place. So you got second chance points off of things that should have never had a second chance.
Another, as the Spurs started killing the Clippers on the offensive glass, it was, you understand why maybe they went with Griffin at center when Kawhi was at the four, but then they brought Diop back and Doc still stayed small and they continued getting killed on the offensive glass. Then I would have gone with DJ back in at that point, but that's neither here nor there. They won anyway.
Yeah.
But, why don't we go through now in depth a little bit more possession by possession, starting with the under six timeout when San Antonio had a 95-91 lead. Pop went to the hack of Jordan on the inbounds there to get the foul. DJ hit one out of two. That was his special. They're not in the bonus, so we can foul him on the inbounds and make him shoot free throws even though they're not in the bonus. And that led to DJ getting taken out and Barnes coming back in for him. So really, you can talk about Pop maintained that strategy worked, the hack of DJ. They did lose ground during it in a lot of the games. I think really the only game you could look at that it worked was probably, I think, in game five, although I may be misremembering that.
I think it worked in this game.
Yeah, okay. So it worked in this game because they took DeAndre Jordan out of the game and then continued getting killed on the offensive glass as a result.
Yeah, I think that there's a big question in this series about what the purpose of hacking DeAndre Jordan is. And for me, the goal in most of the circumstances was to take him out of the game. And if that's the goal, most of the time Popovich got what he wanted.
Yeah, another reason I think that they took DJ out was when they went small, they got an easy, easy pick and roll layup for Duncan. And Blake couldn't help because he was guarding Danny Green. I think that might have been part of the impetus as well for going back to being small.
Yeah, there were a couple of reasons. And on the other end of the court, not having the same kind of spacing, I think, helped them out as well because you had so many guys that you had to respect if you're the Spurs.
Yeah, that's true. DJ, he kind of provides his own gravity with his rolls to the basket and just being the dunker on the baseline where Blake can throw him that alley-oop off the short roll. But yeah, I was still saying DJ should be back in, but, again, it ended up working out for Doc. I don't know if the process was great there. Then the J.J. Redick show started. Redick made an unbelievable three in transition. He got a dribble handoff from Blake, and Redick went to his right. Manu was right there, and Redick was still floating to his right. Such a hard shot floating to your right for a right-handed shooter from the right wing. Nothing but net, just drained it.
Yeah, absolutely. And what was so impressive to me about Redick is he's one of those guys that I never think of him, and it's unfair on my part, I never think of him as really a hard shot guy. But in this game in particular, his two in the fourth, and then I think there was one in the first quarter where I was kind of in awe. It was one of those just big shots. Jamal had a few of those, but Jamal has been that guy almost his entire career. But Redick really brought it on that sense, and they weren't giving him easy ones. It wasn't, that spot up in the corner kind of, I joke about it as kind of the Klay Thompson play of he's wide open, he gets a perfect look and drills it. He hits some really, really tough plays in this game.
Yeah, so San Antonio calls the timeout. It's tied at 97. They bring Diop back in, and at this point now you would think they would bring back DeAndre. They did not. Barnes is still at the four. And this is when the offensive rebounds really started killing him. The Spurs ran a great play. The elevator doors going to the left wing for Green. Redick does an awesome job getting through and denying Green. But then, you know, we talked about how elevator doors doesn't have that great of a counter. On this play, the Spurs did have that. And Duncan set the elevator door screen. Parker then set a cross screen for him. Got a great pass to Duncan right in front of the charge circle off that cross screen. Paul was either unable or didn't help, and Griffin couldn't get through the screen. It was an easy layup for Duncan. Then after that, Redick comes down, a dribble handoff from Blake, does the flyby fake on Green, drains another three, and the Clippers were up by one at that point, 199.
Yeah, and then for my big question going into the next session was, you know, what were the Spurs going to try to do? What were they going to look to accomplish? And they had Tony Parker. He had a drive, and I'm still amazed that he made that shot.
Yeah, he's got some of the best touch of anyone in NBA history from that dreaded like 3 to 9 foot range with his floaters. Paul did a nice job. He's kind of a barrel chested guy, bodied him up, but Parker was able to finish it. And another key play I thought was right after that, the Spurs shut down everything that the Clippers wanted to run. It ended up with Blake with an ISO on Duncan, top of the key. And what Blake did is it really shows you a great thing for young players. Duncan was laying off Blake by probably about 7 feet, and Blake was, you know, maybe 20 feet from the basket. Instead of just settling for that shot, what Blake did was he took a dribble in, and then he actually took a dribble back. And even though Duncan was pretty far away from him, he took just a half step forward. And even if there's a great space differential between the offensive player and the defender, if the defender takes a step forward, if the offensive guy times it right, he can still blow by that guy just because his weight is forward. And that's what Blake was able to do. He got to the lane, got fouled, drains both his free throws. You know, as we talked about, he was fantastic from the line.
Yeah, it was a huge possession, and one of those things that we talked about that the Spurs did a couple times, I was thinking of that Diaw play at the end of Game 6 where he did that, is you need to be able to execute when things don't go right. And this was the first game where I really thought the Clippers had it. They had a couple possessions. There was one with Jamal Crawford where he just drilled a shot. It was one of those you just kind of felt, oh, they're not going to get anything in this possession. And in a game where, you know, it looked like it was going to be close the whole time, it was close the entire time, those possessions in some ways swing it more than the beautiful plays.
Yeah, I mean, and frankly, you know, we talked about who was playing better. The Spurs were getting rebounds, they were getting great shots, they were just missing them, whereas the Clippers were just having a lot of tough late clock shots. I mean, every single one of these shots, you know, are either late clock, contested, great shot, but, you know, the Clippers just have that kind of talent and, you know, to some extent, that kind of luck in this game. This now is really when the offensive rebounds started. Diaw posted up Barnes. Barnes did play great defense. Danny Green got the rebound. Barnes then gets back, blocks his shot twice, but there is nobody else who could get a rebound. I mean, Redick, Crawford, and Paul just not even making any kind of effort, just not in their DNA. Paul's a good rebounder when he's healthy, but obviously he wasn't going to be doing that in this situation with how injured he was. And so then Duncan got the and one, missed the last free throw. Diaw gets it after a Kawhi tip out, and Parker has a wide open three, in and out. Kawhi gets another rebound over Blake Griffin, puts it back in, and at this point you're starting to think, you know, it's 105-102 Spurs. You're starting to think, all right, you know, it's starting to fall apart here for the Clippers. Where is DeAndre? The Spurs are big. Why isn't he in? You know, are they just afraid of the hack of DeAndre? Why isn't he there? They're getting killed on the glass. It looked like it wasn't going to go the Clippers' way at this point.
Yeah, it wasn't. And that led into, well, there was a little bit before that, but what led into the sequence of what I think you and I both think was the biggest, in some ways, the biggest shot of the game. And so Chris Paul had a shot. It didn't go in. I didn't love that look. That was one of my not favorite looks in that game. And then Parker tried another tough shot. Similar thing, you know, it was those guys have the confidence in those looks, but you have
I wouldn't characterize that as a tough shot, actually. I mean, he came down in transition. It's a floater. I mean, I think that's a very good shot for him, and it just happened to rim out. I mean, I think that's one that he would want back. you know, for sure. He would tell you that he should probably make, in contrast to maybe that other one.
That's fair.
But then, you know, in transition again, Redick was able to get a drive past Kawhi. Dia helps from the top of the key. He's guarding Barnes. Probably more help really than was needed. You know, JJ Redick isn't going to score in the lane with Kawhi kind of right there on him. But Barnes drained that three at the top of the key to tie it at 105. And, you know, that sequence, as you mentioned, was huge.
Yeah, it absolutely was. And I don't think at that point, did the Spurs ever lead by as much as three the rest of the way?
No, that was it. I mean, I don't think did they take the lead at all? I don't think they did.
I'm not sure they did. We'll
get
there. We'll go through it.
We'll get there. Another Spurs missed easy shot, followed a Dia post up on Barnes. He went right across the lane, you know, about 4-footer. Not an amazingly easy shot, but he kind of flubbed it. Didn't even really give it much of a chance to go in. And then it really started getting incredible defense here with Paul did a pick and roll to Griffin. He got ice, threw it back to Griffin coming down the lane, and Danny Green, who is just somehow incredible defending the basket, just blocks Griffin. At that point, there was an easy layup on Redick in transition for Parker, potentially a foul. He missed it. Dia gets the offensive rebound. Green misses a wide open three, and Parker tips it in. And that really was Blake Griffin's fault, and he just didn't get back at all. I mean, there was a missed layup, an offensive rebound, a missed wide open three, and another offensive rebound, and Blake never got back during that entire period. And, you know, he looked at the ref. He didn't really get back. And I think what happens, a lot of times, you know, you'll say, oh, you can't, don't scream at the refs. Like, the reason I think that a lot of players do that is because, you know, you're in front of 18,000 people. And if you miss a shot, or much worse, get blocked, it's a little embarrassing. And if you turn to the ref, that's kind of a way of saying, oh, wait a minute, like, 18,000 people? I got fouled here. This wasn't really my fault. Like, it's the ref's fault for not calling it. And it's a very human response to do that. But, you know, that's what you see happen time and again. And I think no matter how many times coaches drill it into guys, you have that feeling, especially guys who get their shot blocked a lot, or guys like Blake who aren't used to getting their shot blocked. They need to show the world that there's no way this was legitimate that I missed this or got blocked, so I'm going to yell at the ref. And, you know, that's sort of one of the mental things that you really, if you want to be, you know, a great player in these crucible moments, you have to get over.
Yeah, and because in this circumstance, it directly hurt his team. Because if he had been back there, not only would the shots have been harder, but I don't think they would have gotten the offensive rebound opportunities they got.
Yeah, I mean, and they weren't even close to getting a defensive rebound in that possession. I mean, Crawford, people forget that he's coming off that calf injury. It's really hard for him to do a dead sprint. That's one of the things that with either a calf injury or a hamstring injury, to do a dead sprint down court. He was trying to run back, and he was kind of limping. He just couldn't do it. You know, and Paul obviously couldn't either due to the hamstring injury. So at this point, they had put DJ back in. Or no, I'm sorry. That's not right. They put DJ back in, I think, at this point, and then they take him out again with a minute 23 left, which, again, I didn't necessarily agree with. I don't know why they did that with the way they were getting killed in the offensive glass, but I think, you know, and it was under 2 minutes, so they wouldn't have been worried about the fouling. I didn't quite understand the rationale that was there for taking him out when you're getting killed in the offensive glass.
Yeah, I mean, and at this point, you know, the trade-off that Barnes had hit that big shot largely because Dia was on him, but at this point, I think you need your best five out there, and I was very surprised that they did what they did.
So down the stretch, the Spurs had Green on Paul, and they had Kawhi on Redick. Is that how you would have gone with the matchups?
I mean, I would have seriously considered Kawhi on Chris Paul, just because I feel like, especially in his, you know, in his limited state, I think to do that. But I don't know. I feel like it was justifiable, but I don't know. My instinct is I would have put my best defender on their best offensive player.
Yeah, I mean, I think the reason why, and it's a really tough call. I don't think there is necessarily a right answer on this one, but Redick had just hit those two remarkable threes on Green and on Manu, so I think the thinking was that there's a little bit more value added, that you take away more from Redick by having Kawhi on him than you take away from Paul by having Kawhi on him.
Yeah.
So I think that was kind of the thinking there.
I agree with that. And Green, I actually like Green more a lot of the time as an on-ball defender than an off-ball defender.
Yeah, so at this point, Spurs are up by two. There's a pick and roll. Blake Griffin gets it swung to him. He really had nothing at the top of the key. Crawford was stationed in the left corner, dead sprints into a dribble handoff off of Blake, and Duncan really wasn't able to get over to Crawford on the help as he curled right into the lane. And I think they had Parker on Crawford there. He wasn't able to keep up with him on the handoff, and Crawford went pretty much right down the lane, made a tough layup, but you know, one where you'd like to be able to get a little more help on, especially in the late clock if you're the Spurs.
Yeah, it wasn't a backbreaking play because it tied the game, but it did show a weakness, because it was one of those, you know, it didn't seem like the Spurs really had anything they could do about it, and Jamal just got there.
Yeah, then the next time down, Kawhi had an isolation on Crawford, couldn't score on him, and I think there's been this rush to anoint Kawhi Leonard as a great player, and he's definitely had his moments. Like, against the Warriors, he was unstoppable offensively. He had some unstoppable moments in this series. But the fact is, down the stretch, a lot of these games, the Clippers get away with having Jamal Crawford guard him and getting a ton of help, and Kawhi wasn't able to make him pay. Maybe that's just he wasn't hitting his shots those couple of games. But, I mean, if you're really going to be an offensive superstar guy that you're running stuff through, like, you got to be able to take advantage of Jamal Crawford in a one-on-one situation, especially when the other team has Blake Griffin at center and Matt Barnes at the four. Not exactly, like, a ton of help waiting for you at the rim. And Kawhi wasn't able to do that in the end of this series.
Yeah, to me, Kawhi is in a similar boat to Paul George before the injury, in that he has a superstar impact on the game, but it's primarily defensive, and some people try to ascribe them being a two-way player and being strong on the offensive end like they are on the defensive end, because our generation hasn't seen a lot of those defense-first two-way players. You know, it's a hard paradigm sometimes to understand, especially with a swingman, because we think about the Michael Jordan, Kevin Durant, LeBron James type guys, and obviously MJ's in a different class in certain components. Peak LeBron was a great defender too, but those guys were all such great, intuitive, natural offensive players with the possibility of erupting. These guys aren't that caliber, and so I think everybody has trouble calibrating that and just thinking, okay, you know, maybe they're not an offensive superstar. Maybe you need to play them with somebody else. But they're still impacting the game in a absolutely massive way.
Yeah, and I don't mean to take away from his overall impact. He's awesome, but I think you get people who, in this rush to ascribe team success to an individual player, as you said, you kind of end up overrating some of these guys. So now there's about 30 seconds left. There's a CP Blake Griffin pick and roll. Blake gets it at the top of the key. Jamal Crawford, in one of my pet peeves, and he's probably one of the worst offenders of this, he stands in a place where he's not a threat to shoot the ball. I mean, and this is Jamal Crawford too. He'll shoot it from anywhere. But he's basically, you know, 33 feet from the basket, straight out. Blake Griffin gets the ball at the top of the key, and Crawford is kind of almost basically standing right behind him. So his man, Parker, is able to just slough off onto Griffin. Griffin has nothing there, and he just has to take a long jumper, not a good shot, that caroms off the rim. Matt Barnes is in the right corner being guarded by Diaw. And another great play by Barnes. He manages to get the offensive rebound. Diaw did not box out Barnes at all. And, you know, traditionalists love to harp on how guys don't box out, right? Like, that's one of those fundamentals that, like, anyone can do at the Y. Like, oh, yeah, I box out. Like, you know, when you get that guy you're playing with who's you know, trying to prove how hard he's trying, the number one thing he always does is, like, try and box out. Like, in reality, though, boxing out is not as simple as it seems, especially on a long rebound, especially when you're not just standing right next to the guy. Because if you're standing, you know, 10 feet in where the guy's at the three-point line, you're not going to run out to the three-point line and put your butt on the guy. Like, that's not how it works. You're never going to get a rebound that way. You're just taking yourself out of the play. So at some point, you have to make a decision of whether you're going to just go get the ball or whether you're going to box the guy out and then go get the ball or just stay boxed out on the guy and hope someone else on your team gets it. And Diod made the decision he was just going to go get the ball. I think that he just got a little bit too far into the lane. Really what you're trying to do in a box out in a rebound situation is control space.
Yep.
So you want to get your body into the guy so that, you know, you have more space between yourself and the basket. And Diod didn't do that. If he had just kind of stayed more towards the block instead of venturing in the lane, maybe he gets that board. But he wasn't able to. And at that point, then the Clippers had another chance to get a timeout.
Yeah, and the way that I like to think about rebounding in that sense is that there are two different goals that you're working at the same time. One is to try to prevent your guy from getting the ball, and the other one is to try to get it for yourself. Because you can be a good rebounder, and people talk about this with certain players, that they're great at making sure that their team gets the board. And this wasn't really one of those circumstances. My read on it, and I could be wrong, was that I think Diaw just, he might have misread where the ball was going to go, and he thought, you know, he kind of read it one way, and it ended up just not going where he thought it was going to go.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it was unlucky. It bounced right into Barnes's hands.
Yeah.
I mean, Barnes, when you're down like that in that situation, he made the right decision to crash the offensive glass, you know, because you know the other team's not going to try and get out in transition. So great job by him. And it wasn't, you know, some horrible, horrible play by Dia, but no. Combined with bad luck, it ended up not working out. So then we saw Doc Staple coming out of the timeout, which was, it was Green guarding Paul. Parker was on Jamal, so they ran, I guess, the 1-3 pick and roll to get Parker onto Paul. And then it was a Griffin-Paul pick and roll. DeAndre Jordan still out of the game. And Paul gets to his spot, his right elbow jumper. And that's actually a good shot for him with the hamstring, too, because he's able to explode off that right leg and come to a stop. Misses the shot. Tim Duncan called for the foul, contesting it. What did you think of that call?
Absolutely correct call. You have to let the guy land. Same issue beyond the fact that he got tackled that I had with the non-call Stephen Curry three-pointer at the end of the New Orleans Game 3 is that you have to let the guy land, and Duncan was just, he was right there. He was standing where Chris Paul was supposed to land. That's a foul. It's kind of an abstract foul in some senses, but when you see it and when you see why the NBA wants that rule, it was the correct call. No questions asked for me.
Yeah, and there are some Spurs fans complaining about the call, saying Paul, like, intentionally jumped forward so he would land on him. No, that's not true. Like, Duncan's body, like, made contact basically with Paul's body. Yeah. And you say, oh, Paul flopped. He basically, like, when you have someone underneath you like that, you need to kind of fall down, and because otherwise if you land full on the guy's foot, you're going to sprain your ankle. And, you know, we saw that. I mean, the reason for that rule is because guys sprain their ankles all the time. That happened to Bradley Beal today in that Washington Atlanta game. So that's why that rule is there. I thought it was a great call. I mean, live, I didn't like it that much. It's like, oh, you know, just let it go this time. But it was pretty obvious and pretty egregious in my eyes. Good call. Paul drains two free throws.
If the Spurs want to complain about a call, they should complain about that basket interference in the first quarter. That was 2 points that the Clippers shouldn't have gotten. So you can complain about that.
Yeah, so... And actually, I was wrong. I'm sorry. The game was tied at that point. Paul gives him a 2-point lead. And then
any,
the Spurs.
Any doubt that he was going to miss those free, that he was going to make those free throws?
No.
No.
So the Spurs advance the ball. They run a play that's they'll run fairly often out of those timeouts where. First, they will bring someone to the strong side along the baseline. That was Kawhi. And then Duncan will flash to the elbow. The inbounder is usually Ginobili in this situation, but it was Bellinelli here. A lot of times they'll try and get a back door on that play. And they've done that many times, just embarrassed teams with that in late game situations. This time, Bellinelli went straight to the middle, got the handoff, rose up for the J from the elbow. DeAndre Jordan, who was back in for defense, did a great job getting out of him, was going to just totally stuff his shot. And Marco somehow managed to adjust in midair at the last moment. Unbelievable play by him to find Duncan rolling down the lane. Redick had kind of veered back onto him. And Redick with the foul. Duncan then makes two free throws to tie the game. I was worried that he was going to miss both of them, and we were going to have to remember the last play of Tim Duncan's career to miss two or miss a free throw that could have tied it, but he hit it, and that set up the Heroics.
Yeah, and the other thing that I'll mention with this is part of the reason that they tell people not to jump without, you know, knowing what you're going to do is because you don't have that much time to make a decision. And what was so remarkable about what Marco Bellinelli did on that play was he made the decision really late. And he let it go, like basically right before his feet hit the ground.
Marco doesn't have a lot of time up there to make that decision. Let's put it that way.
No, he's not prime Vince Carter. I mean, it wasn't much time. I was sitting there, and I followed Marco his whole career, and it was just sitting there like he doesn't have the time to get this. Like I saw the pass a millisecond before I like right about when he saw it, and I'm like, there's no way he's getting this off. Even if he sees it, I thought he saw it, and to get it off and to get even free throws off that was a huge success, considering DeAndre would have, you know, that would have been kind of a star-making moment for him, but Marco took it away and then let Chris Paul have the, not star-making, but star-crystallizing for the people who, for whatever reason, are dumb enough to think that Chris Paul hadn't already done that.
Yeah, so there's 8.8 seconds left, tied it at 109. Clippers advance it into the front court, and they ran just an incredibly simple play. I shouldn't say incredibly simple. It had some nice elements to it. Griffin got the inbounds, handed off to Paul, and Griffin went like he was going to set the screen to Paul going left, which, as any veteran Paul watchers know, was not the direction that he likes to go. And Paul froze Danny Green with an inside-out dribble, just did a straight-line drive past him, rejected the screen, and didn't blow by Green. Green was in the play. Paul was able to come to a stop off one foot, his left leg, stopping your momentum like that and going up at the same time with a bad hamstring. I have no idea how he did that. Duncan was able to get over there, almost got a piece of the shot, and Paul drained it. Really unbelievable play. I can't say that enough, how difficult that is. And there was a decent play design, too, for the Clippers. They had Barnes space out on the left wing. And then Redick actually started on the baseline. He was being guarded by Kawhi. And just as Paul started his move, Redick then sprinted towards the top, occupying Kawhi, preventing the help from him. So that worked out pretty well. Ginobili got over, and he was in position for the rebound. Griffin saw the shot go up, just total disregard for his body, took off from like the dotted line, and Manu tried to box him out. Griffin just got knocked on his butt, but he might have been there, actually, for the offensive rebound on that play. So that was just unbelievable, giving up his body by him, even though it didn't end up necessary. And 1 second was left at that point.
And since Chris Paul's shot didn't hit the rim, you didn't have to worry about offensive goaltend part two. Which, can you imagine if that had happened?
Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, that would have been. At least they would have been tied. So yeah. At least they weren't down one. But nonetheless,
I don't think we can talk enough about Chris Paul's play on this. I mean, it was such an amazing play. And also, I mean, I hope it's not the last play of Tim Duncan's career, but he did everything right too, as far as I could tell. You know, he got as close as he could. It just went over his outstretched arm. You know, it happens. You know, it was one of those defining plays, and it was also like it happened a lot in this game, but and it shouldn't matter what round a series happens in, but you kept on thinking like this should be for more than it is, and that play was a first round play, but it could have been a championship play as far as I'm concerned.
Then there's 1 second left. Scale of 1 to 10, how unfair was it for the Spurs that the horn went off, sort of giving away what their play was?
Yeah, I'll go with a 7, but, you know, that's a part of the game. You know, there are unfair things happen all the time, but it did suck for them. And it was kind of funny that I guess there wasn't a way to shoehorn it in, but that was not included in the last 2 minutes ref report that came out. They didn't go, oops, inadvertent horn that revealed what play you were calling.
Yeah, I haven't seen that yet, but I saw on Twitter that it actually said they had no errors in the last 2 minutes.
Yeah,
is that right?
That's what I remember, and it is. I don't remember any missed calls. Obviously, that was a mistake that was notable, but they didn't. That's kind of a different thing.
Well, so I'll tell you who thought it was a 35 out of 10 on the unfairness scale, and that would be Spurs owner Peter Holt.
who was
featured in some GIFs today. You know, just absolutely berating the scorers table. You know, but that's neither here nor there. But that was a little bit of an amusing moment.
Actually, I will mention it is on the last 2 minutes report, but it doesn't have a thing about a call or a no call. It just has a blank. It just says the clock starts prior to the inbounds. It should say sorry or oops or something, but it doesn't. It just says it doesn't have a correct call, incorrect call. It's just blank because there was no call. I mean, I guess that is in there as an apology, but I mean that sucks. But at the same point, you have 1 second left. Granted, the Spurs know better than almost any team what can happen with a second or less left in a game, but that's dredging up another painful moment from their past. So I'm sorry.
A couple interesting strategic notes on the last play. The Clippers had Jamal Crawford in the game. I can't imagine what the reason for that would have been. But they did do a nice little switch. They had actually started off with Griffin on Matt Bonner, and then they had Jamal on Kawhi Leonard. And Kawhi Leonard basically started off on the left block, and so they decided to actually switch up those assignments. Either because they didn't want to risk a throw into the post to Kawhi on Crawford, or because they felt like they were going to be able to switch that action if Bonner came through. But for whatever the reason, that worked out reasonably well. The play was for Kawhi to go up towards the elbow, fake like he's coming up to the top of the key, and then curl back around to the basket. Matt Barnes made a great play to deflect the pass. It may have actually been a little bit long from Dia. I'm not sure if Kawhi would have gotten there to put it in anyway, although if anyone with his hands could do it, it would be him. An interesting point that Rick Fox made on NBA TV afterwards, Marco Bellinelli was on the right wing. The inbound came from the left hash mark. And he said that Bellinelli should have come up to the top of the key to make Barnes make a choice, essentially, because that pass to Bellinelli was too far away in the air to where Barnes felt like he could still get back to the basket and help. If Bellinelli comes up to the top of the key, then Barnes has to make a decision between helping and getting Bellinelli, really clears out the backside. So I thought that was a good point. I think the play could have been a little bit better to prevent Barnes from helping. But, you know, he still made a great play to get there with his man at the three-point line.
Yeah, my read on it was that the pass was a little bit long. I don't think he would have gotten there. I'm not willing to say it definitively because there are so many things that are out there. But Rick Fox's point was really smart. You know, it's that the goal of any offensive play, you can think about it as basically as this, is you're trying to force the defense to make decisions. And anytime that you're allowing a guy to be in a position that is uncomfortable for you as an offense, you could probably do something to prevent that. And that I think was what he was getting at with Marco. And I agree with him completely.
Yeah. I mean, especially if it's a guy like Marco who can shoot the ball, you should be able to put him in a position where he has to be guarded. And that didn't happen on that last play. So we've been going pretty long here, obviously. Last question, best first round series ever in your mind?
I can't think of one better. You know,
what are some of the other candidates for you?
Was it a Mavs Spurs series? Not the one when the Mavericks, you know, when Manu made the bad foul. That was the conference finals. But I think there was one
the second round. Actually,
oh, that was second round. Okay,
should have been the conference finals. finals. But
I know there was a good Bulls one a couple years.
The Bulls Celtics.
Yeah, that's the one.
2009.
Okay.
2009 is when that was. Yeah, that was the year that KG was injured. But I mean, I really think the stakes are much lower in that series, just a much lower overall talent level with KG out, and that was kind of an ad hoc Bulls team at that point with Rose just a rookie, and a lot of those guys, you know, didn't end up being a part of like a real great team once the Bulls got better. That series probably had more overall great competitive games with like overtimes. They had the triple overtime game. But the game seven was kind of a dud, and also you kind of had this idea that neither of those teams was ever going to really go anywhere. So, I mean, I would say, you know, Memphis, OKC through maybe the first five games last year was amazing, but then those last two games were kind of dud blowouts. You know, you could maybe look at some of the upsets, like, you know, 94 Nuggets. Beating Seattle, but I don't think that all of those individual games were as good as here, and still also not the same overall talent level. So I think, you know, and I'd love to hit me up on Twitter at NateDuncanNBA if you think you have a better candidate for best ever first round series. I mean, I guess 84 Knicks Pistons would be another one where Bernard King had that unbelievable game on the road and Isaiah Thomas brought him back, but I don't think. Other than that game five, I don't think the rest of those games are really that great. So, hit me up on Twitter if you have any other candidates, but I think this is my leader in the clubhouse for the moment.
One other thing that will affect the legacy of this series is that the game itself dramatically affected the likelihood of either one of these teams making and winning the championship, because Chris Paul's injury makes it substantially harder for the Clippers. And one of the things that I've been thinking about today on Sunday is, will people think of this series differently if the Clippers get knocked out by the Rockets in the second round?
Yeah, they may well. I mean, it'll kind of be more of a footnote, and we'll maybe, and especially it'll still be, I hope to God this isn't true, but if it's still going to be Chris Paul's never made a conference finals after that, after he basically, like, you know, just wrecked his body trying to win that first round series, that epic first round series. You know, but yeah, so actually one other thing we should do before we close. I put out my picks on Twitter for this series. So do you have yours? I mean, I think we've already seen the first two games of these series, but I think we can be honest about what our picks were beforehand.
Yeah, let me.
And I'm on record. You want to look yours up? I'll give mine.
Sure.
Yeah. So I had Hawks in five. Wait, is that right? No, sorry. Hawks in six. Cavs in seven. Houston in seven. And Warriors in five.
And what's disgusting to me is I wrote down my picks last night and didn't. I decided I wanted to sleep on them. And then I saw your tweet in the morning and my picks are the same. And I feel terrible about it. I also feel terrible about it because you and I only had one discrepancy in the first round. And it was that you said the Clippers in seven and I said Spurs in six and you were right. So this also means that I can't eclipse you because we said the same. It's immensely depressing. It's just, it's horrible. Ugh.
Yeah, but we'll see. I expect my golden touch. I did go 8-for-8 in the first round, at least in terms of winners. But I expect my golden touch to dissipate quite soon. So don't go betting on those. I am by no means a professional.
Well, I'm sure we'll have plenty to talk about in terms of the Hawks and Six prediction that we both made.
So what is your rationale for we can get to that on the. Our tomorrow's podcast after we've seen a game from that. This has gone long enough. Thank you, dear listeners, for hanging on this long. It was an epic game. Hopefully listening to a podcast that was half as long as said epic game wasn't too much for you. Thanks again. You can subscribe on iTunes if you want to give us a rating. That's always helpful help us keep this going. You can follow Danny on Twitter. Danny LaRue is his name, and I'm Nate Duncan, NBA. Till next time.